Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the world change when Western society discovered gorillas in the mid-19th century? As many Americans and Europeans were beginning to process the ideas contained in the writings of Charles Darwin, a young man named Paul de Chaillu was exhibiting evidence that he had encountered gorillas on his travels through Africa, confirming the existence of a primate species previously suspected to be the stuff of myth. But the world beyond the African continent seems to have been conflicted about the news, as de Chaillu's fame was suddenly clouded by suspicion and debates raged over evolution, race, and religion. Monty Real is a former correspondent for The Washington Post. He writes about this fascinating time in his new book, Between Man and Beast, An Unlikely Explorer, The Evolution Debates, and the African Adventure That Took the Victorian World by Storm. Monty, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
I always love stories about fascinating historical figures that I have never heard of. Can you talk about how the story of Paul de Chaillu came to your attention?
Yeah, well, he was someone I had never heard of either until several years ago. I was actually reading a book by an explorer, a geographer, and kind of all-around Victorian adventurer named Richard Francis Burton. And he had written a book in about a travels that he had done in 1861 and 1862. And the book was called Two Trips to Gorilla Land and the Cataracts of the Congo. And I just started reading this kind of as a just purely recreationally. I was reading a lot of 19th century travel writing just because I found it a lot of fun. And in this book, Burton makes several references to the controversy and the sensation that had just kind of overtaken England at the time he decided to make his trip. His trip specifically was into Gabon, which is a country in Western Africa, right along the equator. And Burton decided to go there to try to see gorillas in the wild. He never did. But in this book, he talks about Paul de Chaillu, who was this young explorer who, more than anyone else, was responsible for really introducing gorillas to the outside world. I hadn't heard of him, so I started to kind of look into his story and found it just incredibly fascinating. There was a lot of drama and adventure in de Chaillu's story, but it was also frustrating as I started to look into it because it seemed like every source I consulted about him told me something different and conflicting. Even the most basic facts, like where he was born, one source would say he was born in Africa. Another would say that he was born in New Orleans. Most of them said Paris. No one could really agree on just the most basic parts of his life. And so as I started to look into that, what really emerged as his story seemed to be both fascinating and a really interesting light on this time, this incredibly rich period of history that really did a lot to kind of shape the way we think of our place in nature now.
Well, as you mentioned, de Chaillu's life was interesting from the start. Tell us a little about what you were able to learn about his parents and his early childhood.
Well, it's funny because during his life, he always threw out sort of false leads about where he was from. He never discussed his childhood. And when people would ask him where he was born, he would always say, you know, he was likely to say a different thing to two different people he met consecutively. He might say New Orleans. He might say South Carolina. But in fact, the evidence shows that he was born in Réunion, which is an island off of the east coast of Africa near Madagascar. And this is a place that has a very pronounced kind of mixed race culture. It's for a long time, it's been sort of a melting pot. And de Chaillu was a product of that island. Records indicate that his mother was actually a black or mixed race woman who was classified in documents of the time was listed as a free colored, what they called then a former slave background. And so de Chaillu likely lived with her, but when he was 17 years old, he traveled to Gabon, And that's where his father was. His father was French. He was a trader. And his father had opened up a trading station in what is now Libreville in Gabon. And Du Chaillu went there in 1848 to join him, presumably to kind of follow his footsteps and become a trader. But when he got there, he immediately fell in with an American missionary named John Layton Wilson. And Wilson was sort of a pioneer in Africa. He was the first. He set up the first mission in Gabon. He had been in. He had been farther north in Africa before that for several years. But in the early 1840s, went to Gabon and set up a mission there. Du Chaillu met him and was instantly taken by Wilson, and was adopted into his family. Wilson and his wife Jane sort of took them in as their son, and Du Chaillu kind of left his father, the trader, and kind of adopted the Wilsons as his parents. And just as chance would have it, a few months before Du Chaillu arrived on their doorstep, John Wilson had collected the first gorilla skull known to science. Mm. And so Du Chaillu kind of walked into his life, into Wilson's life, at this extremely opportune moment. And he lived with Wilson then for several years. And Wilson, during this time, was trying to amass whatever information he could about this animal that he had collected. When he got the skull, no one knew it was a gorilla. The gorilla wasn't even an animal that was known at all to science at that time. The skull and other bones eventually made their way to Harvard here in the U.S., and an anatomist there named Jeffries Wyman classified the animal, named it the gorilla. And so science kind of had this now on record. And Wilson, meanwhile, in Africa, was just trying to learn whatever he could about it. And the only real way for him to learn about it was to talk to native traders, people who had perhaps glimpsed the animal in the wild or known other people who were said to have seen it. Seen one. Most of these were hunters, Native African hunters, and there had been this just incredible folklore that Wilson kind of tapped into. He learned that this animal that that was known in the native languages as an ingina, that was the name of it there. There was just this mythology surrounding it. People would talk about how it possessed supernatural strength. That if it saw a human in the forest, this animal would invariably attack, and it was incredibly savage and dangerous. They even talked about how it was known to supposedly abduct women and take them away in the forest. There was just all these kind of wild, incredible stories that Wilson was collecting, and all the while, Du Chaillu was right there living with him, hearing about all of this. And he was, as I mentioned, a young man. He was 17 when he met Wilson, and impressionable. And this, you know, was sort of the atmosphere that he came of age in, hearing all these stories. So several years later, in the 1850s, Du Chaillu came up with a plan to go on an expedition into the interior of Gabon and to try to confront gorillas and be the first person to describe them in the wild.
And we should jump in here because Du Chaillu, if you'd taken a look at him walking down the street, you would not have thought there strolls an explorer. He was sort of physically slight, right?
Yeah. He was, some magazines actually referred to him as the last person you would look at and think of, this is a great African explorer. He was very small, just over 5 feet tall. He weighed about 100 pounds, was very thin. And he was young, but even more than that, he looked younger than he actually was. If you read almost any description of him in the press when he just sort of first gained fame, they almost invariably commented on his childlike nature. He was very enthusiastic. He kind of just bubbled with this energy that was always described as childlike. And so he didn't kind of fit that stereotype of the swashbuckling, you know, physically vigorous guy who goes into the jungle to face these terrifying beasts. He gave a much different impression when you saw him in person.
So what did it take for him to pull together the necessary resources for this first big trip?
Well, there weren't a lot of resources to be pulled together. He actually, with Wilson's help, he had gone to the United States to teach French for a brief period in the state of New York at a school. And while there, he had noticed that the thing that really earned him respect among people that he talked to was his time in Africa and his stories about the wildlife there. So he wanted to go back. So he arranged with the Philadelphia Academy of Natural Sciences to try to go back to Gabon and take this expedition into the interior. And the Academy said that they would back him. They gave him sort of a verbal commitment that they would provide some resources to help him with this trip, and they would display and take specimens that he would collect. That ended up not being exactly the case. Dushayu went there, and it was really a kind of a do-it-yourself adventure. It was kind of a seat of the pants, just entry into Africa. If you look at the other explorers of that time, and just to take one example, Henry Morton Stanley, mm-hmm. when he went in to search for David Livingstone in the famous expedition to find Livingstone, he estimated that his traveling kit, all of his equipment that he took in on that expedition, weighed about 11,000 pounds. And he had hundreds of porters who helped him carry all this stuff and guides to go into the forest. All of Dushayu's equipment, whenever he first went into the interior, fit in one single dugout canoe. So this was a very much a small operation. And he would kind of just proceed and make connections with different tribes that he encountered, and he tried to get sort of backing from the tribal leaders to make introductions to other tribes.
Excuse me for interrupting. It must have been helpful for him to have had a sort of adoptive father with a missionary background.
Yes, and he also, his experience there while he was living with Wilson, and he would also do a few trade jaunts for his father. So he had some experience with the languages, which helped a lot, and just some familiarity with the area. Wilson was also very, very well respected on the coast. And traders that would come in, they would often travel from the interior with things like ivory, and they would travel to the coast to trade with European ships that would go there. Well, those traders, a lot of them, knew of Wilson, and he had a good reputation. So Dushayu's connection there certainly helped him in making at least the initial contacts with people.
My guest is Monty Real. He's a former correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the new book Between Man and Beast, An Unlikely Explorer, The Evolution Debates, and the African Adventure That Took the Victorian World by Storm. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. SMU.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Monty Real. He's a former correspondent for The Washington Post, now an author, and his newest book is called Between Man and Beast, An Unlikely Explorer, The Evolution Debates, and the African Adventure That Took the Victorian World by Storm. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So Monty Duchailloux sets out. It's he doesn't bring a lot of gear with him. It's dangerous. It's uncomfortable. And he's out there for a long time before he actually even spots a gorilla.
Yeah, he spots his first gorilla in 1856. And he's, you know, he's ventured quite a ways into the interior of Gabon. And he's had, I mean, this is a young kid, essentially, who's searching for adventure. And he gets as much of it as he can handle. Eventually, he's with some other group of hunters that he's kind of recruited to join him, and he's walking around at the foothills of the Crystal Mountains in Gabon, and he sees a group of figures that are just kind of a blur, and this is his first glimpse ever of gorillas in the wild, and there it's sort of gone before he even has a chance to kind of figure out what it is and get a good look, but he knows that he's close. And his attention just at this point kind of turns into trying to find gorillas and get a specimen. And by getting a specimen, that means hunting them.
Yeah, that was the way things were done. Right now it sounds really barbaric to us, but that's the way naturalists would have looked for and sort of sent specimens back, was to kill them.
Right. This was in the days before, you know, nature photography or anything like that. So hunting and science they just went hand in hand at this point. The most sort of famous naturalists, even people like John Jay Audubon, whose name now is sort of synonymous with conservation, he was a hunter, and so he would go out and hunt, you know, birds and shoot birds, and he would mount them and paint them. That's how they worked. Duchailloux, similarly, in collecting his specimens, went out to hunt them. And by the time he emerged from the forest, so to speak, in late 1859, he came out with more than 20 gorilla skins, which he had stuffed. He was also a taxidermist, essentially, so he stuffed his specimens. And so he emerged from the forest in 1859, late with these specimens that he was going to sort of bring to the world.
And the first time he actually shot a gorilla, almost before he knew it, his crew had eaten the gorilla.
Right, yeah. And Duchailloux later, in writing about his adventures, he was quite a storyteller, and so he would, you know, kind of wrench as much drama out of incidents as he possibly could. But that is one scene that he actually he describes quite vividly, as being around sort of a campfire while his hunting companions divvy up the gorilla, essentially the first one that they had collected. He was trying to measure it and, you know, take all sorts of, you know, account of what this animal was, but before he knew it, it was pretty much gone. It was interesting in reading that, because one of the things that I did for this book was I traveled to Gabon, mm-hmm, and spoke to hunters there now to try to get their kind of, you know, what they know about gorillas in the wild and what stories are still told there. And it was interesting that when Duchailloux was with his first group of hunters, when they encountered and successfully shot the first gorilla, the hunters talked about the almost magical powers that consuming a gorilla would give them. They thought that this might help them become better hunters, that they, by, you know, successfully bagging this almost, you know, unachievably rare specimen, they thought that that would somehow confer a special kind of hunting power to them. But when I was in Gabon, I was kind of amazed when I was talking to some local hunters there that those stories still exist. They still talk about people who They reverence the gorilla, but in a way that it almost has this kind of magical power. It was just really kind of interesting to hear the stories that they told of hunters that they knew who had seen, or they don't go out and hunt gorillas today, of course, but who had kind of had encounters with gorillas, that somehow conferred a special status on them now as well.
One of the things that Dushayu was able to observe, I guess from his dissection before he taxidermied these animals, was that, in fact, these things that had been reputed to be like the most fearsome beasts on the planet ate mostly plants.
Yeah, no, they're gorillas, as we know now, are they're not violent animals at all. They're vegetarians, essentially. And Dushayu, you know, he had been hearing these stories and this mythology about the fearsomeness of the gorilla before he goes out there. And that, of course, kind of colors his perceptions. He has no frame of reference in which to view these animals. So he's expecting a monster. And when he sees them, that's really what he does see. He sees this, you know, enormous, hairy, incredibly strong animal in front of him. So he's scared. And his original descriptions of the animal do definitely, you know, kind of convey that sense of fear. He describes it as a hellish dream creature, is his words. But it really is, you know, it's a gentle giant, we know now. One of the things that a gorilla will do, and if it feels threatened, it will charge. So this is not really an act of violence, because if a person just kind of sits there and doesn't react and doesn't further threaten the gorilla will veer off. It won't charge you and attack you. It's just running at you to scare you away. This happened to Dushayu. He describes this charging beast. Of course, he doesn't know it's going to veer away, and he shoots them. So he thinks that these animals were coming to attack him. And that's sort of a perception that lingers, because there was no way for him to know or intuit that these animals weren't, you know, really violent and weren't really going to hurt him. He was just kind of going by what he saw, and what he saw was a show of intimidation, not a real attack. But when he looked into like the contents of their stomachs and things like that, he found only plants. These were not the violent meat eaters that had been described in the mythology.
So what happens? He comes back from Africa. He's got all these specimens. And we should say he took other animal specimens as well. It wasn't only gorillas, but those were the most interesting to the public. What happened when he went public with his findings, and what was the reaction?
Well, it was interesting. He first went back to the United States, and he went to New York, and he actually opened up a quote-unquote museum on Broadway. So he took the gorillas first to Broadway, and he took out an ad in the paper in 1860 describing Dushayu's exhibits, and for a quarter people could come into his almost like storefront museum there on Broadway and view a stuffed gorilla and all of the other specimens that he had brought back. A couple of things sort of upstaged this debut. One was P.T. Barnum, who was the world's greatest showman, of course, is just down the street, and he has his own museum. And when Barnum gets wind that somebody has come and is claiming to be displaying this brand new quote-unquote man monkey in a museum just down the street from his, Barnum kind of goes on the offensive. And he comes up with a display that he calls the What Is It? And he claims that this is his own man monkey, and it, unlike Dushayu's, his is alive. It is a fake, of course. It's a complete fake. It's essentially a man in a monkey suit. But Barnum, having a lot more resources than Dushayu, floods the newspapers with ads and totally upstages Dushayu. At the same time, New York is very distracted because the Civil War is about to break out. Mm-hmm. So Dushayu goes to London, and this is where the specimens really kind of take off and something called guerrilla fever kind of grips London at this time. He is invited by a guy who's a scientist named Richard Owen. Owen is the dean of science at this time in London. He's the head of the British Museum, the natural history collections there. He's an anatomist who coined the term dinosaur, for example. And he's just at the absolute top of the heap of British science at this point. He brings Du Chaillu over because the Darwin debate has emerged. It emerged at the exact same moment Du Chaillu came out of the forest with these specimens. It was just a complete coincidence. But at the same time Du Chaillu emerged from the forest, Darwin published his book on the origin of species. So at the same time that scientists and academics were really starting to debate, you know, the links and the possible kinship between men and apes, this new ape is, you know, bursting onto the scene. And Owen thinks this can help him combat Darwinism. Owen is an opponent of Darwinian theory. And he wants to kind of incorporate the gorilla into his argument against natural selection. So he kind of helps Du Chaillu come to London and introduces him to the movers and shakers of the day. And he gets him a stage on the Royal at the Royal Geographical Society. And this is where Du Chaillu's gorillas really have their sort of red carpet debut in London, and they take the city by storm. People are absolutely enthralled by these creatures, and Du Chaillu is just instantly elevated to the status of celebrity.
What was Du Chaillu's relationship to Darwin's ideas?
He was always kind of vague about what he thought about this. He really just kind of stumbled straight into the heart of this debate by no real intention of his own. He was much more into this for the adventure of it, and he was interested in it, but he didn't really have a stake in the scientific debate that was just emerging at that time. He aligned himself with Owen, and Owen's argument, he wasn't anti-evolution. Owen believed in transmutation, which is what evolution was most commonly called then, but he didn't believe that humans had this kinship with apes or other creatures. He thought that humans followed kind of a unique path, a separate evolutionary track, and that he called it ordained continuous development, that there was a divine hand that had set that in motion. And that's where Du Chaillu kind of aligned himself with Owen, who had befriended him and really kind of made him what he was as a celebrity at that time.
So it sounds like you're leading us, Monty, to a happily ever after story for Paul Du Chaillu, but that's not how it turned out.
Not at all. There were lots of bumps in the road. He, as I mentioned, he's just, you know, kind of elevated, put on this pedestal in London as this great explorer, and he just has all sorts of fame thrust at him. The gorilla is a really pop cultural phenomenon at this point, and it's right at the height of his fame, right at this point in 1861, attacks start being made on Du Chaillu's credibility. And some of them are justified, and Du Chaillu cannot really argue against them because whenever he went into the forest, he had no scientific training. So a lot of the observations that he made, for example, his maps that showed his route in Africa, they were flawed. And, you know, when people looked at them closely, they found mistakes. And similarly, he, in his book, described quite a few other species that he listed as new and undiscovered. And zoologists had kind of a field day picking out examples in that new and undiscovered list of animals that were well known to science already. Mm-hmm. And one, in fact, was on display and living in a London zoo. So there wasn't much that Duchaillou could do to argue against that. But once these attacks on his scientific credibility started, it really snowballed. And people started to question him. Wanted to kind of know whether it was possible that he had made the whole thing up. People started to say, well, maybe he didn't even go into Africa at all. Maybe he just stayed on the coast, invented his travels, made up these stories about encountering these fearsome gorillas in the wild, and just collected these specimens, you know, from traders as he sat on the coast. And so Duchaillou is kind of weathering all these attacks, defending himself, and then the attacks really start to get personal. And rumors about his ancestry start swirling around.
About his race is what you mean.
About his race, mm-hmm. Yeah, about his African ancestry. Because at this time, the Royal Geographical Society, for example, there are no minorities allowed in the Royal Geographical Society. This is a completely white male-dominated scientific establishment. And so rumors start to swirl that he might be of mixed race. And there's another person from Africa, a guy named Robert Bruce Walker. He's a trader in Africa as well, and he starts kind of making these hints to the papers in London that Duchaillou is not who he says he is, and just starts attacking his credibility. And the combination of all of these rumors, all of the attacks of his stories, really sort of chop away at his credibility, and he's forced to take a second expedition to try to prove that what he described and where he went actually occurred. So he actually challenges his critics to go with him.
Let me jump in. We need to take a quick break. My guest is Monty Real, former correspondent for The Washington Post, author of the new book Between Man and Beast, An Unlikely Explorer, The Evolution Debates, and the African Adventure That Took the Victorian World by Storm. We'll be back in about 2 minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with former Washington Post correspondent Monty Real, whose new book is called Between Man and Beast. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Monty, Duchaillou has been disgraced. He decides, fine, I'll do this all over again. And, boy, this second trip was a tough one.
Yeah. It didn't go as he planned. He went back to Africa, back to Gabon, this time with a lot more stuff. And before he left on this, he decided to kind of apprentice himself to the best scientists in the world, to learn how to make maps that are accurate, to learn how to take pictures. He had gotten a camera at this time and was hauling all these glass plates into the jungle because this was before film is even invented. So he's got a lot more stuff this time. He goes in immediately before he even hits the coast. He gets into a canoe off of the ship to go into the beach to set up, and his canoe is overtaken by waves, and he loses a lot of his stuff. This is how it starts, and it just gets worse from there. He goes into the forest with a larger group of porters and assistants, and somewhere along the line it becomes clear that someone in their group has smallpox and is spreading basically an epidemic through the tribes. They get deeper and deeper into the forest, and this epidemic just follows them, and it just ravages whole villages. And obviously, you know, the tribes do not want this coming into their territory, so the whole expedition is tainted in a very obvious way. And it takes Dushayu a long time to realize that they're the ones that are actually helping to spread this. Mm. And when he does realize, it's really too late, and he's sparked a lot of conflict between his group and the tribes that he's traveling among. And essentially, he has to flee the forest in an extremely dramatic way, under the hail of arrows, being chased out of the equatorial forest by tribes that really have been decimated by, as a sort of, as a result, an indirect result of his own expedition. So he's racked with guilt, racked with sort of depression as he leaves, and he considers this expedition a complete failure whenever he eventually is set to return to England. He hoped it would be his triumph. You know, he hoped to emerge with more specimens, with photos of gorillas in the wild, but he had none of that. He basically had to ditch everything that he had in this flight from the interior. But the one thing that he did keep was his notes. And before he had gone on this expedition, he had sort of learned how to take very precise observations, scientific observations, and these really saved him. When he got back to London and addressed the Royal Geographical Society again and other professional groups there, his descriptions this time rang true. And, for example, the maps that he made, the astronomical observations that he had made to create his maps and give precise coordinates to his travels, these were all highly praised, and it gave legitimacy not only to this, to what he had seen on that recent expedition, but also to the one that he had gone on several years before.
Did you find any evidence at any point that he was deliberately fabricating details to make better stories?
Yeah, there are definite exaggerations in his stories. They are not necessarily outright lies, but he will take a detail and embellish it to the point that it becomes something other than truth.
Mm-hmm.
He was very much interested in entertaining his audience. And in fact, in the years that followed that second expedition, he became known more as kind of a lecturer and an entertainer, going around, for example, the United States on tours. And he was particularly popular with children. And he even wrote five books for children, sort of adventure tales. And it was he was very animated when he delivered these lectures. He told stories that really played up the drama and the danger of what he had encountered, almost to the point where they seemed like fiction. And what's interesting is that those stories that he told and the way that he told them really did have a pretty profound influence on the way stories were told, particularly fictional stories. Dushayu's books and his sort of reputation as a storyteller helped to really form the action adventure genre as it kind of developed in the late 19th century and early 20th. And you can just kind of look at a lot of the kind of landmark books from Arthur Conan Doyle's The Lost World. That's one that, you can almost read Dushayu's dramatic arc, his personal dramatic arc, and look at The Lost World and see the exact same storyline in that. King Kong is, of course, another one that's kind of obvious. The story of that, Marion Cooper, the writer and director of the 1933 version, the original version of King Kong, had later said that his inspiration was Du Xiaoyu, that when he was about 7 years old, he first read Du Xiaoyu's first book, and from that moment on, sort of the course of his life had been set. Mm. So Du Xiaoyu's, you know, his kind of fanciful way of telling stories had this kind of another unintended effect on generations that followed him.
How did all this research, I mean, we've talked about the debate about the way that evolution played out, but how did all this news and information play into the rise of a more fundamentalist form of Christianity?
Well, there's a few ways. Whenever Du Xiaoyu's specimens were first introduced, it really helped give a face, first of all, to the evolution debate. Darwin's book, On the Origin of Species, it actually doesn't even mention the possibility of human-ape links. It doesn't get into human evolution really at all. It's implied in that book, but he doesn't directly address it. When Du Xiaoyu's specimens sort of overtook England, that became kind of the symbol of the debate at that time and really helped push it, you know, out of the realm of academia and into the streets. This was something that, you know, was all over pop culture in England at that time, in cartoons, in the newspapers. Everyone was talking about these gorillas. So this is what kind of got the conversation going in, you know, on the streets and also in churches. There was a very popular preacher in England named Charles Haddon Spurgeon. And Spurgeon in 1861 opened the Metropolitan Tabernacle in London, and this was a huge church. It seated about 5,000 people, and he was the superstar evangelist of the day. And he got a copy of Du Xiaoyu's book when it came out and seized upon it as a way to get his followers and his church talking about the evolution debate. So he actually invited Du Xiaoyu and actually put a stuffed gorilla in the pulpit of the Metropolitan Tabernacle and delivered a lecture about the gorilla that was completely oversold, and they had to turn people away from this. And this was one of the very, very first instances of kind of religion and science intermingling in a very public way. Spurgeon's lecture on the gorilla was attacked by the press for kind of blurring the lines between the sacred and the secular. Before this, there weren't a lot of members of the clergy who would talk about things that were in the news or things that were being debated outside of the church. And when Spurgeon talked about the gorilla, he was really sort of attacked in the press as kind of overstepping the bounds of the church in some ways by just broadening the discussion to things that some critics thought the church shouldn't really get into, these social debates. Spurgeon thought that it was only natural, that this was something that affected his faith, that it was affecting the people in his congregation, so he jumped right into it.
Where are Du Xiaoyu's papers kept now?
They are spread all over the place, and that's one of the reasons I think that he kind of fell through the cracks of history. When he died, his estate was worth less than $500. Hmm. He had given away almost everything he owned. And basically, there was nothing really left. His letters and his papers now can be found in the collection of others, contemporaries of his. So if, for example, you look at the collection of John Murray, who is a famous publisher, he was Du Xiaoyu's publisher, you'll find a lot of correspondence between Du Xiaoyu and Murray. The same with other explorers of the day. He was corresponding with some other members of the Royal Geographical Society. So the Geographical Society has some letters that he sent to other explorers. So they're all scattered around in these sort of individual collections, which makes it hard to really kind of research him. And I think that's one reason why, you know, he kind of fell through the cracks and was not really, didn't really become a name after his death.
Did you feel like you were, I mean, to a greater extent than other projects you've done, really sort of doing detective work on this?
In some ways, yeah, because it, you know, a lot of this stuff is just extremely contradictory, as I mentioned before.
Yeah.
It's fun to kind of go through encyclopedia entries shortly after his death just to see the differences in, for example, the place of birth. Even his tombstone, he's buried in New York, and his tombstone lists his name, his date of birth, place of birth, date of death, and almost everything on the tombstone is wrong. They got wrong the place of birth, the date of birth, even the date of death. So these things that are, you know, even written in stone, so to speak, those facts, when it pertains to Du Chaillu, don't really hold. So there's a lot you kind of have to dig a little deeper than you normally would to kind of get at the true story.
Was it easy going through the papers and notebooks that you were able to access to get a sense of, like, his personality beyond other people's accounts of someone who was very ebullient? Did you sense you knew him by reading his writing?
A little bit, yeah. Because his writing in his books really does kind of come off as very similar to some of his writing in his letters.
Mm-hmm.
And he has this, he does convey this sense that you cannot miss of a guy who is just filled with enthusiasm, and it's very hard to kind of burst his bubble of optimism. Even when things are very, very bad, he tends to take this, this sort of optimistic view of things that almost, you know, makes you want to question whether it's optimism or naivete at some times. But he has this kind of likable character that comes through, even especially when he's sort of being attacked. He has this, he kind of floats to the surface all of the time with his optimism.
I guess that allowed him to survive some very difficult times and situations.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, in the 1860s, after he kind of reached that level of fame, his name was really for a while synonymous with a fabricator. And he had to wait to sort of try to get his vindication. So that obviously would sort of put anyone's optimism to the test. But it's interesting in reading not only his writing, but the writing of others who are sort of witnessing this unfold and how they describe him, kind of, you know, always looking on the bright side of all those things.
Monty Real's new book is called Between Man and Beast, An Unlikely Explorer, The Evolution Debates, and the African Adventure That Took the Victorian World by Storm. Monty, it's been really interesting. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
No, thanks very much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.